Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There are a number of rights that are part of our DNA as citizens of the United States, among them the right to protest. This country started as a protest movement against a king, and our founders enshrined that right in the First Amendment of the Constitution. Recently, millions of Americans participated in the No Kings marches to protest what they perceived to be autocratic policies of the current administration. Did they make a difference? Do most protests have an impact? Protesting may be a right, even a tradition, but do they matter? This hour, we leaf through the pages of history for an answer. We're joined by Gloria J. Brown Marshall, professor of constitutional law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and author of A Protest History of the United States. Scott Huffman is with us. He's director of the Center for Public Opinion and Policy Research and professor of political science at Winthrop University, and WFAE's own Nick Delacanal, a reporter and host of All Things Considered, is with us because he's been covering local protests for many years now. Thank you all for being here. Good morning.
Happy to be here.
Good morning.
Gloria, I'm going to start with you. Protesting, as I said, is a constitutional right as long as protests are peaceful. And in fact, you say that every right that we enjoy comes from a protest. Are you referring to how the nation was founded or to something else?
To both. The nation was founded, as we noted, as the Declaration of Independence is a protest document, protesting the way that King George was handling the colony. But we also need to know that there could be laws enshrined on paper, but they don't mean a great deal if they're not really part of our reality. And protest takes the word from the paper and makes them a reality in our day-to-day lives. And I like to give the example of the 8-hour workday. That was something that was enshrined in law in the 1800s, but it did not become a fact in our lives until the 1900s. And that's because even though the law was on paper, we take it for granted every day, it took lives and livelihoods and protests in order for it to make it our reality. And that's about, you know, things that we take for granted everywhere. Labor strikes are protests. If you start expanding protests beyond marches in the street, you'll see that we've been protesting in large and small ways even before the country was founded. And so that's a part of our day-to-day life and history. But we take protests for granted. We always think somebody else is supposed to do it and that the rest of us are supposed to enjoy it.
Yeah, and you, even though these are the right to protest is enshrined in the Constitution, some people still view them as a nuisance. I believe I'm right in saying that you view them as a civic responsibility.
I think it's very important. I mean, day-to-day people take for granted the benefits of protest, but they don't want to be bothered by protest itself. And one of the aspects of protest is disruption. And so when we're disrupted, when we can't go where we want to go because the streets are blocked, when we hear people saying things that we may not agree with, we have to think about how we have benefited from protest and have more patience. Also, those who are protesting need to understand that one and done is rarely the way a protest is effective, that protest takes time, even as we start off with Declaration of Independence and the different aspects that came up to and led to the Declaration of Independence. We have to think about most protests against corporations, the government, local, state, or federal, did not have an effective change the night before or the night after based on the protest itself. It took time and many protests for things to actually work.
And some view political protesters, particularly with suspicion, even derision. And obviously that's because the people who are viewing them that way are on the other side of the aisle, but not necessarily. Sometimes within parties, people don't want people to protest. Others have a knee-jerk reaction. We're witnessing an attempt to clamp down on the most recent protests in Los Angeles, which I believe is where you are this morning, Professor.
Yes.
In a nation where peaceful protests and the right to protests are constitutional, How do you explain this desire almost always to clamp down on these protests?
I look at it in a way that Martin Luther King stated it. We, he said, have to protest for the right to protest. That's how much people did not like protest. That he, all of his protests, and he's seen now as this person who gave us the gold standard for how to have peaceful protests. But the Constitution doesn't say that the protest has to be peaceful. It says that we have the right to assemble, we have the right to freedom of speech. And that last line in the Constitution, the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances, to petition, to ask the government to fix, redress our grievances, complaints. We have that right in the Constitution, even though most people rely on freedom of speech. The word protest is not in the Constitution. And so up for, I would say, most of the country's history and around the world, protests were not peaceful. Protests were very rambunctious when they said that the masses were rising up against, you know, corporations or the government. They were not peaceful protests. So Mahatma Gandhi and Bayard Rustin, Martin Luther King brought in the notion of peaceful protests. The Quakers brought in the notion of peaceful protests, but they were in the minority for the most part.
Which is more effective? Because you've written a book on this topic, A Protest History of the United States. And as far as we can determine, our staff can determine, it's the only book about the history of protests in the United States. So which is more effective, the peaceful protests, the nonviolent protests, or the ones where things get out of hand?
I sometimes go back and forth. There are experts who have said that civil resistance without violence is the most effective. I know that the civil rights movement was a majority peaceful protest, and peaceful meaning that when people were attacked, so there was always violence. What made it a peaceful protest, a nonviolent protest, was the fact that the protesters who were attacked did not respond with violence. That's why we need to be clear about what we mean by a nonviolent protest. And also, the nonviolent protest means that people who are protesting are not, you know, destroying public property. They're not trying to harm other people. So when we start thinking about a nonviolent protest, we're thinking about, can we effectively get the result we want, for example, voting rights, with nonviolence? Yes, voting rights became the outcome, but many lives were lost on the path to voting rights. And so we think about nonviolence as always being the protester being nonviolent, where we have many people around the protesters who are very violent. So I think that violence is not and should not be the ultimate way in which a group is attempting to make social change. But we also need to understand that a human being wants to, by nature, protect themselves. And so when they are attacked, not everybody who takes on the philosophy and training of nonviolence can do so. Let me give this quick example. In Selma, Alabama, where I was as part of the 60th anniversary of the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where peaceful protesters were attacked by government and deputized people who were intent on giving harm and bloodshed and even take lives. Those protesters, many of them were students at the time, high school students, and they took actual classes every week, if you can imagine, in high school, to take an actual class every week in the philosophy of nonviolence so that they would understand what would be expected of them when they were attacked. So this assumption of nonviolence is something that we talk about today without understanding that people took classes in this. They had to understand it. It was a philosophy of life. It was not just this reaction that you're supposed to be nonviolent. So I do believe that nonviolent protest is effective. I do believe that it can be useful even today. But I also think that people take for granted that nonviolence is just something that a protest is supposed to be, and that's not historically correct. And also that everybody understands the philosophy and have taken on and embraced the philosophy of nonviolence, and that's not the case either. So I think violence is going to continue to be a part of protest as long as violence is used against protesters who have a right to protest in the first place.
Dr. Scott Huffman is also with us from Winthrop University, professor of political science. And when people protest something, Scott, that is political, it's often difficult for those on the other side of that issue to see those protests as legitimate. The people protesting the Vietnam War were characterized as leftists, as Marxists. Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew, referred to them as nattering nabobs of negativism and portrayed them as disruptive and unpatriotic and working to undermine American values and national unity and on and on and on. Looking back, is that what they were? Is that what they were trying to do? Unmute yourself, Scott. Scott, unmute yourself.
Of course they weren't, you know, the negative. They were trying to affect change, as Professor Brown Marshall was saying, but how they were seen is a whole other question. If you can demonize your opponents, demonize folks on the other side, then they have to explain why what they're doing is necessary. And, you know, the classic phrase is, if you're explaining, you're losing. People, you know, in America are far less informed than a lot of folks think they are. Poll after poll shows that folks can only name one or two of the rights guaranteed in the First Amendment. As Professor Brown Marshall pointed out, the word protest doesn't appear, and your average person cannot define what redress of grievances means. So when people are hearing about a protest, they are only being informed by the lens of the media, and the media needs to show a burning car to get eyes on the newspaper, to get eyes on the television, and the subtlety of what is being protested is completely lost. And that's not the fault of the person who has a 40, 50-hour job to work every week. It's kind of the fault of how the information is presented, and it's presented in the most sensationalist way. And the quickest message that can be put across in this is they're horrible destroyers of our society, and you should beware of them. And the reason we are primed to expect that is the way we're conditioned from childhood.
We're talking about protests, and do they work? Have they worked down through history on Charlotte Talks on WFAE? Gloria, in the 1960s and 70s, obviously there was a time of protest, both the Vietnam War, protests against that, protests in favor of civil rights. Both of those seem to have been very successful. They moved the needle, or looking back on it, it seems to be so. Would you say that those two movements changed the trajectory of the country?
They changed the trajectory of the country. But one of the things we have to understand is those movements were over time. And we look at perhaps the last Vietnam War for one was a creep war that took time to actually be established as a war. And people were protesting it from the very beginning, protesting different aspects with what led up to the Vietnam War and then protesting the war. So we're talking about years of time. The civil rights movement began, if you look at it, with the Montgomery bus boycott, if you want to look at that as an official start in the 1950s, but then we don't get the Voting Rights Act until the 1965. So if we think about this one and done aspect of what we want everything to be done right now, yes, it's effective, but it's effective over time. And that time is what people don't want to put in anymore.
I have about 30 seconds left in this segment, but does it take time because it takes time to sink into people's psyche through media coverage and constant exposure to what the message is of these protests and the protestors? Or is it simply because of other factors? Let's leave it at that.
Other factors, and the fact that these are minorities fighting against a system. The system took time to get in place, so it's going to take time to undo that system.
Gloria Brown Marshall is a professor of constitutional law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and author of A Protest History of the United States. She's here along with Dr. Scott Hoffman, director of public opinion and a professor of political science at Winthrop University. And Nick Nellicanal is with us. He's a reporter here at WFAE and host of All Things Considered. We're going to talk to him in a few minutes about local protests and their effectiveness. Stay with us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the history of protest and their effectiveness throughout the history of this nation, where it is enshrined, the right is enshrined in the Constitution, with Dr. Gloria Brown Marshall, professor of constitutional law, John Jay College of Criminal Justice, author of several books, including A Protest History of the United States, and not only a published, but a produced playwright as well. She's here along with Dr. Scott Huffman from Winthrop University and Nick Della Canal from WFAE News. Scott, a 30-year history conducted by the Stanford Graduate School of Business and by the University of Pennsylvania found that spikes in protest activity by both liberals and conservatives can increase or decrease a candidate's vote by enough to change the outcome of an election. Do you know of any other research that would make that true or emphasize that as a fact?
Well, one of the additions to that is I would say how much it changes, whether or not it can make a difference, depends on whether the candidate is an incumbent or not. Because as with money, the impact on an incumbent is usually a lot smaller. Because, you know, the things that can move the needle about an incumbent are often have to be huge because their opinion about them is set in stone. So things like that are more likely to move the needle on the newer or the challenging candidate.
Does that help explain perhaps why some candidates or even office holders have a viscerally negative reaction toward protesters? Because they know if the message gets through, their seat is in jeopardy.
Well, I'd say that goes both ways in that, you know, some folks know, hey, if this message comes through, the things I'm pushing are going to be very unpopular. But on the other side, there's a huge discussion going on apparently in the establishment of the Democratic Party between the folks who are saying, hey, we as a party need to run towards the center. That worked for Bill Clinton back in 1992. So we need to not take positions that people would want to protest or else we'll lose. And the other side is saying, look, the era of parties is not what we need to be saying about. Folks hate the establishment, whether they're a moderate liberal or a strong leftist, moderate conservative, strong on the right. People are hating the establishment. And so your question about whether or not it helps or hurts, people should run for it or not, actually assume something about the two-party system that may be evolving.
You talked about how people may... I'm sorry, I'm not awake yet. But you talked about how people view these politicians, view these as well, maybe we won't get involved with that because it'll lower our ratings. But President Trump has seen his ratings, Gloria, fall precipitously in recent days. And yet, not only has he decided to bomb Iran, he's brought out the National Guard in California without Governor Gavin Newsom's request. He brought in the Marines out there to quell a disturbance that evidently in a city of several million people only involves about three or four square blocks. Some people have referred to that as overreaction. Is that because he may fear those who are loosely tied to his MAGA coalition might be swayed by this and drop away from that coalition?
You know, people use attacks on protesters for various reasons politically. Sometimes it's to firm up their base. Sometimes it's to send a message to anyone else who might also want to protest that this is what's going to happen to you if you decide to lift your voice up and join others in the streets. And then in a third area, if you start thinking about George Wallace and others, it's like to show this law and order type of demeanor that we're going to show our base and the rest of the country that these disruptors of the status quo will not be tolerated. So there are many ways in which they believe being hard on protesters is going to benefit them as politicians. But in some ways, if the protesters stay the line, it backfires. So they think they're going to gain this momentum from the conservative side or the side that's against the protests. But we've seen from the Vietnam War protests, the civil rights protests, the women's rights protests, and many others, that if people can stay the line with the protest and have an effective strategy with that protest, it's not just an emotional thing, that the politicians will turn, because the people would begin, as Scott pointed out, to understand what the issues are that the people are protesting, and then start to gain some type of attraction to the protesters, even if they don't go out and protest themselves.
Scott.
Yeah, just to follow that up, you know, in the early part of the question you asked, is Trump fearing losing support? And to add on to that, there's something I've been looking into in my latest data. This is not published yet because the sample sizes are too small, but have been breaking up Republicans into how they identify themselves primarily. Or do they primarily identify as MAGA Republicans, America First Republicans, or traditional Republicans? And what I've seen is, although their behavior in voting for Trump and supporting things in general appear the same from the outside, on the inside, there are some very different attitudes on things like the economy, to a lesser degree on tariffs, although on immigration, it's the traditional Republicans who are very different than the America First and the MAGA. But here's where Trump may fear losing support, back to the original question. The America First Republicans were all in on Trump because one of the things he promised was to not get enmeshed in foreign conflicts. And so we have seen an instant pushback among some of his reporters in Congress. Great example is Thomas Massie. Thomas Massie, I said, he's from Kentucky, 4th District, a Republican who said, look, I was America First before Trump even came along, and we need to focus on America and stay out of these foreign entanglements. So these divisions that I'm sort of playing with, looking at the Republican Party, MAGA, America First, traditionalists, haven't been showing because the Venn diagram for issues is almost a circle so far, but we're beginning to see cracks show. And that's when you see Trump worrying about losing support, and he may flip back and take strong actions that he knows all three types of Republicans may jump in behind.
Gloria.
Just another point on that. The cracks also show when you are using American military against civilians. And so you could have the libertarians, you could have other people who are probably in that conservative tent who are saying, wait a minute, you've gone too far. You've taken this to a whole other level. And also the idea that, they were for arresting and deporting criminals among the migrants, and now they're just sweeping up people and then deporting them willy-nilly. You have other people who believe in the rule of law, and having this administration ignore the U.S. Supreme Court and ignore, you know, the rule of law. And so there are ways in which people who might have been within that tent, as Scott has pointed out, who are not able to express their disillusionment with this administration, because they then will become attacked. And that's something that's also known by this regime, that they will attack their own or attack anyone who disagrees with them or right. embarrasses them.
Nick, I believe you had your hand.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I mean, there was some speculation that when Trump was sending in the National Guard to California, that perhaps he was trying to provoke a conflict. And I don't want to get inside anybody's head. I would never know what somebody else's motivation was. But I think that if you looked back, even at the protests in Charlotte in 2016 over the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott, or in 2020 when we had those 2 weeks of George Floyd protests, when police came in and used force against protesters, like with tear gas or pepper balls, at times that did seem to inflame the protesters, sometimes make things worse. And I think that kind of fires up both sides, actually. And it's sort of a gamble as to where it might move public opinion. And I think it does respond or depend a lot on how protesters respond.
Like I want to bring you into this conversation from the local angle, particularly of those protests that resulted here locally from the death of Keith Lamont Scott and the later death of George Floyd. But before I do that, Gloria, I have a question for you about that, because the protests that surrounded the death of George Floyd at the hands of police in Minnesota were global. They took part in this country for night after night, day after day, for a very long time, and spread around the world. In the course of that, 17,000 people were arrested nationwide. But it is estimated that 93% to 96% of those protests were peaceful. Yes, there was vandalism. Yes, there was property destruction and clashes with police. But the majority of these conflict, or of these protests, rather, were conflict-free. Changes did result, but did those changes come as a result of the sheer number of people and the sheer number of days that these protests took place over? Did they come from the fact that the majority of people involved were peaceful?
I think it was also the fact that the murder of George Floyd was something they could see. It was very visceral and moving. And to have the protests of young people and just diverse different groups of people, intergenerational protests, as you pointed out, in small towns and in large cities, people were saying, this morally is not what this country should be about, that you have put in our faces, which is something Martin Luther King used to try to do, take the moral issue from a peaceful standpoint, put it before the public, and let them judge themselves in the quiet of their own homes. What do you believe in? Who are you as an American? Who are you as a human being? So I think that the effective use of protests is seen in the George Floyd protest movements, and that criminal justice reform resulted from those protests. And yet there are people who said they were against the way they protest, but they weren't against why they were protesting, because it's understood that the reason they were protesting was valid, and that no one should be treated this way. And if police officers are continuing across the country, and they still are, taking over 1,000 lives a day of civilians, that there should be something done about it. And one of the things you mentioned before is, if people, and Scott mentioned too, if people know, they can better judge, they have time in the quiet of their own home. But sometimes in the George Floyd protest shows this, and so did Occupy Wall Street, in other ways in which even small towns were involved in these protests, that people have to be in their own time, in their own home, asking themselves, what happened? Why are these people protesting? Why does it mean so much for them to put themselves in harm's way? And then begin to wonder, is there something actually there that they should be, as human beings, as Americans, thinking about and changing their minds about? It takes time to change anyone's mind on anything. And so it's going to take time when it comes to social justice for people to change their minds about a law or an activity or something that's so institutionalized as our police department.
So, Nick, you've been covering these protests in Charlotte, I think, since 2016 for WFAU.
Yes, long time. Yes,
a long time. So let's drill down into some local history here. You covered the protests that followed the deaths by police of Keith Lamont Scott. Those protests were not organized marches; they were organic eruptions, and they erupted in various spots and places all over town and at different times. And the response by police was highly criticized by many of the participants and by some of the observers. Remind us what these protesters wanted and whether they achieved their goal, or was this just a way to let off steam?
Those are great questions. I remember the people started to gather the night of the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott. This was up here in the university area. Mm-hmm. The protests started peaceful as night fell. But then they started to get more violent. Protesters were throwing rocks and water bottles. Police arrived in riot gear, and then there was tear gas and pepper balls, and then there was some looting, and it did get more violent as the night went on. Did it result in anything, any policy? I would say not really, but I think what it did do was it brought a lot of visibility to the issue, and I think it set the stage probably for the 2020 protests, where we saw a lot more policy changes here locally.
Well, a lot of things came out of that. There were changes in police procedure that came out of that because people witnessed some of the things that were going on and they didn't like them. And it launched a political career of Braxton Winston, who is famous for the picture of him standing there with his shirt in his hand, waving it with his back to the camera. And he later became a city council person.
Yeah, he did. So I think it elevated some local voices for sure. Not only Braxton Winston, but also you might remember Toussaint Romain, mm-hmm. who became sort of a peacekeeper, and he later went on to lead the Charlotte Center for Legal Advocacy. Although, I don't know if there was that much policy change. There were some investigations, but there were no indictments. I think it did bring a lot of more attention to the issue, though, locally.
Well, one change was a court order that halted CMPD's use of riot control agents like tear gas against peaceful protesters. And I'm wondering if that is still in place or whether that was temporary and it has expired.
Yes. Yeah, so that actually came out of the 2020 protests over George Floyd.
Okay.
And this was, this came out of an incident on June 2nd when protesters were trapped between two lines of police on a city block who fired tear gas. And the problem there was protesters didn't really have a place to exit, and there wasn't any warning that was given. So, there was this lawsuit, there was a settlement, and there were a number of policy changes that came out of that. That settlement was in place for 4 years, so it actually expires next month. That's when it expires. I did actually send a message to the police department earlier this week, just checking in and asking, what's the status here? Are you guys going to keep some of these changes in place, like not using tear gas on protesters, not using no knock warrants? That was another one. I haven't gotten a response yet, so I don't know.
We're talking about the effect of protest, whether they are effective throughout history this morning on WFAE and Charlotte Talks. We mentioned that the George Floyd protests, I think 125 people were arrested in Charlotte for those protests, but that number of arrestees has dropped considerably since then. What are the figures? What are the statistics?
Yeah, this was something that I worked with my editor. So we wanted to keep track of all the people who were charged in these protests and then see how many of these charges actually stuck. In the end, 71% of these people who were charged had the charges dropped. There were a couple different reasons for that. This was also coming out of the pandemic when there was this huge court backlog. So the DA's office was really overwhelmed with cases. So they decided to just dismiss all of the nonviolent charges. And I can't really compare that to what we've seen from other protests. But yes, in that one case, 71% of protesters had their charges dropped.
The recent No Kings protests that were taking place all over this country, millions of people, I think, in thousands of cities participated, including Charlotte. And we had an event on that Saturday that lasted for about 2 hours. They assembled in a park. They did a little walking. They dispersed 2 hours later and went home. I don't believe there was any violence, and I don't believe there were many arrests. I could be wrong about that. Correct me if I am wrong.
There were two arrests towards the end, and I think that there was a scuffle between protesters and police. There was some pepper spray deployed, but this was sort of after the main protest. Mm-hmm. So I think that was sort of an isolated incident.
We'll come back and talk a little bit about those protests around the country and whether they are effective in what has been referred constantly to as unprecedented times. I don't think that's hyperbole, but we'll talk about it and more with Nick Della Canal from WFAE, Dr. Scott Hoffman from Winthrop University, and Gloria Brown Marshall, Professor of Constitutional Law at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Gloria Brown Marshall, Professor of Constitutional Law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the author of A Protest History of the United States. Dr. Scott Hoffman does all the polling you hear about from Winthrop University, where he's a professor of political science, and Nick Della Canal is a reporter for WFAE News. Gloria, since you wrote the book on the history of protests throughout our history, have most of these protests been peaceful, or have most of them been violent? Have most been productive? Did they move the needle? And who protests more often, liberals or conservatives?
Well, I would say the majority of protests, might have some violent aspects. And I ventured to West Virginia to look at the labor strikes there for the coal miners. So those are protests. And in order for us to create the labor unions we take for granted today, those workers had to protest to unionize. And there are bullets that are still lodged in the brick buildings in coal mine country where the shootouts took place between the coal miners and people who worked for the corporations. So the protests have been involved violence most of the time without this idea that they were supposed to be nonviolent. As I said, Mahatma Gandhi brought this concept of nonviolence in protests, and how if you get, you know, so many thousands of people together to disrupt through nonviolence, stop traffic, make people think about this topic in a way in which they can then consider, is this the way they really want to live? Can they understand why people are protesting and what way do they want to participate in the protest? And going back to whether or not they're liberal or conservative, it really wasn't down those types of party lines most often. It was whether or not they were part of the status quo or believed they were part of the status quo. And what do these disruptors want from our society? Why do they want to change things? The majority of people don't protest. It's always a fraction of people who can benefit from the protest who actually do the work. So that's why it's difficult to break it down just by party lines. It's usually those who believe in the status quo and those who actually want the change.
But gathering in a park, getting a parade permit and walking down the street, closing it off to traffic is one thing. Burning buildings and cars and throwing rocks and injuring people is another. And people don't like that. But they also don't like these marchers who suddenly take over highways and block traffic in all directions. So how do you get attention to the cause that you're trying to make changes in without ticking off the very people who might support you and move the needle?
Well, that's a tricky thing. Just think about the filibuster. The filibuster is used, it's protest, it's used by politicians to disrupt. And so people want the disruption as long as it's for their cause. And there are those who, and I remember being in traffic on West Side Highway in New York City, where all of a sudden thousands of people stopped traffic. And that was very inconvenient for us, but it was also something that we need to understand, that the protester is trying to get out a message. I'm concerned that if the message is blurred, if the message is not clear, then people are just angry because they've been disrupted without any clear message as to what is it that you want. It's not just what you're protesting against, but what is your vision for change? And unfortunately, if it's just an emotional protest, I'm protesting against this police violence against civilians, I'm protesting against how a corporation is treating its employees, then what do you want? Do you want better hours? Do you want a raise? Tell us and articulate it. And if there's no clear message, if there's no clear leader, and a lot of these protests now are leaderless, And so then people are feeling like they've been harmed, they've been disrupted for no reason, and that it's just an outlaw type of thing where you're just being a miscreant, you're not really about a social purpose.
Nick.
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in too, because I think the 2020 George Floyd protests in Charlotte were kind of a good case study, because there was a mix of peaceful protests and some more violent actions. So there were headlines of looting and cars burning, but also towards the end of the protests, you saw a lot of art coming through. The city painted this Black Lives Matter mural along Tryon Street, which also got a lot of big headlines. So I think that there are different ways to get headlines and to get attention and get results that way.
Scott.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on some of the cool stuff Gloria was talking about. One, and this is something I am not an expert in, but I've read about, is the impact of modern architecture on behavior and on protest. You know, here's a crazy idea. Cities being designed for cars in the modern era make it easier for protests to cause problems and congestion and get people irritated. Whereas in the era before cars, walk around it and it didn't have the ability to cause quite as much disruption in a city. The other thing is, you asked about, you know, liberal versus conservative. That's often labeled in hindsight as from what modern people are viewing what was liberal or conservative. As Gloria was talking about, a lot of folks, you know, wanting to unionize, wanted to do so in order to live decent lives, get paid fairly. And we only look back on that as so-called liberal because more unions donate to Democrats today. To bring this home to the Carolinas, the uprisings of 34 in 1934, all through textile mills in the Carolinas, especially in South Carolina, there were huge protests to just want enough of a wage to be able to live. And it ended up in a massacre down in Honey Pass, South Carolina, where the mill owners had hired folks to, quote unquote, protect property and shot a bunch of protesters. So again, in hindsight, oh, they're for unions, they're liberals. No, that's a modern take.
Protest movements are always aimed at people in authority because if you want change, it takes people in authority to agree to make those changes. But there seems to be a difference about what's going on now. And when we look back on the No Kings March, it is against what they appear, what these people appear to believe is, with some justification, an authoritarian streak in approaches from the Trump administration on many different policies, including the ICE roundups of undocumented immigrants at places of work and near schools, at courthouses, by people not offering or wearing identification as ICE or law enforcement who present no arrest warrant, to the treatment of Democratic lawmakers and congresspeople and senators who are trying to exercise oversight of the executive branch and then are put on the floor with handcuffs, sending people without due process to foreign jails, without access to lawyers, cutting funding to universities that don't agree with the MAGA movement. Have you conducted, Scott, any local or regional polls that will tell you how the average person is reacting to all of this?
Well, one of the questions I asked that kind of gave me a little bit of insight, there have been previous surveys decades ago that basically said all systems of justice make mistakes, but which is worse, convicting an innocent person or letting a guilty person go free. I asked the question, all systems of immigration make mistakes, but which do you think is worse, randomized, to deport a legal immigrant or let an illegal immigrant stay? Now, a majority of people in the poll said, whoa, it's worse to deport a legal immigrant. However, among Republicans, traditional Republicans, over 40%, nearly 43% said, it's worse to deport a legal immigrant. But you get down to the MAGA Republicans, only about a fifth, a little over 20% said it's worse to deport a legal immigrant, and they would much rather deport a legal immigrant than let an illegal immigrant stay. So what's driving a lot of people's opinions on this are, okay, what is the flip side? If A happens, am I more concerned with B? And when it comes to immigration, which is worse? And for a lot of folks, it's, hey, it would be far worse to keep an illegal person than it would be to deport a legal person. That's using legal and illegal the way they're used in the media as opposed to documented
and
undocumented.
And so, but you didn't ask about how they felt about the methodology of doing this.
This was right before the ICE protest. We did ask about bringing Garcia back because this was before he was brought back. And, among all folks, yeah, most people were saying, yes, we should bring him back. Among Republicans, the America First and traditional were actually really close on this, with about 30% saying bring him back. Only a small slice of the MAGA Republicans said bring him back. So, again, this is what's worse. Deporting someone who shouldn't be, or, you know, keeping someone.
Gloria.
I think it also goes to the moral imperative. And that's something that you began the show with. Who's going to have the moral imperative? Where does it lie? And there's a battle over the moral high ground. And so when you see in a protest, and Martin Luther King did this exceptionally well, because he would even use the violence against the protester to show that we have the moral high ground over here, and that what you're doing to us as protesters, all we're asking for is what's in the Constitution, what are our constitutional rights. And then you have what's been wrested as the moral high ground to the other side is these people in the country are doing harm to other American citizens. And that's why if we make a mistake about deporting them, it's okay because we're still saving lives. So you see this battle going back of who's got the moral high ground.
And I think that when you lose the moral high ground, ultimately you lose your battle against these protesters, because that's what happened with the civil rights movement. When people saw what was happening in places like Selma on television, it became crystal clear to a lot of people that this is wrong, and the forces for good began to prevail. I want to get your take on this, Gloria, because Donald Trump made a Truth Social post in March in which he said all federal funding will stop for any college, school, or university that allows illegal protests, and added that agitators will be imprisoned or permanently sent back to the country from which they came. Is there any such thing as an illegal protest? It's in the Constitution.
It's in the Constitution, but we're talking about somebody who doesn't read the Constitution and really has shown outright by his own measure and words that he has no real respect for the Constitution. That is what he wants, and he can make up whatever rules he believes he can, because in many ways, that's why we had a No King's Day, because he's put himself forward as being a king. And so he's lawmaker from legislating with executive orders. And this executive order, like so many others, sets out something that has no definition to it, what an illegal protest is. Is it a violent protest? Is it saying something he doesn't like? So it puts people in a very confused state, but it also is part of a terrorism against protests and against free speech that will have a chilling effect, meaning people will be afraid to exercise their constitutional rights. And that's not new. That's been something from the very beginning. We were talking before about the coal miners and about other textile workers. It was this idea that if you raise your voice, you'll lose your job. And the coal mine companies and other textile companies owned the homes, and they had the stores and they had the schools. And so if you lost your job, you lost your community, you lost your home. So there's always been this threat of violence, this threat of arrest. And so this is not new. It's just on a very high level, and it's rarely come from the president himself.
We're talking about protests this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. The freedoms granted by the First Amendment, Gloria, for citizens to peaceably assemble, to seek redress of grievances from the government, only works, as you just pointed out, if you believe in the Constitution and if you believe in democracy. Under this current administration, is that belief at risk of fading?
I think we're in a constitutional crisis, in which we have an executive branch that has overstepped by far what the framers believed would be the powers of the president. And having the acquiescence of the Congress to allow the president to legislate with executive orders, and having a supermajority of conservatives on the Supreme Court that basically is giving him much more than I believe that the Supreme Court should be giving the president under these circumstances, means that the people have to now speak up. What the framers did was to give the people the right to protest, to give the people the right to assemble, and to petition their government for a redress of grievances. So we are the backup plan under the Supreme Court. When the other three branches of government are not doing their job, then the people become the backup plan, and those people have the right to speak up, to protest in many different ways. It's not just going in the street. Rosa Parks did not give up her seat. That was protest. So whether or not one takes a knee, does a boycott, meaning being selective with their purchases, there are many ways in which a person can let their voice be heard. And I think we, the people, are having to speak up to make our government realize, be a mirror, that it's in the wrong direction and that it needs to change course.
So, Scott, we have this Congress, a do-nothing Congress, that just goes along with whatever the president wants because they're Republicans and they're lockstep with Donald Trump. And as I said, democracy can only fade if we let it. You teach young people every day. And those young people are often criticized, perhaps unfairly, for being disinterested and being disengaged. Have you found that to be the case when it comes to these topics that we're discussing today and the attack, essentially, on the First Amendment and democracy?
Well, a lot of students, and this may shock you, avoid political science classes. But fortunately for us, in South Carolina, actually, you must pass a class to get a college degree that teaches about the Constitution. So I'll get students in my classes that, you know, might not have taken it otherwise. But when we talk about these rights, yeah, they get engaged. And one of the things that Gloria hinted at or said that, you know, we may be entering a constitutional crisis. This is something I hammer home to my students, and it would worry them. And it did at the end of last semester, is that we have a three-legged stool, you know, of checks and balances, and the courts are one of those. If the executive starts ignoring court rulings, you're sawing off one of those three legs.
And there is some evidence that came out yesterday that in fact is exactly what they intend to do and have been doing. With that, we have to stop. The last voice was Dr. Scott Huffman, director of the Center for Public Opinion and professor of political science at Winthrop University. And Nick Delacanal was with us from WFAE News. Also, Gloria Brown Marshall, professor of constitutional law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and author of A Protest History of the United States. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.